Yeah, my name is Carrie. I'm a recovered alcoholic. My home group is the New Horizons group, and I'm currently living in the disciplines of 10, 11, and 12. Hi, Kat. It's been a while. Kat from Colorado is with us tonight. I haven't seen you for a while. It's nice to see you and everyone else. So just get right into it because we're on the third week and I haven't even made it out of the foreword. So forward to the fourth edition. All right. I am working out of the abridged version, which is what I call the study edition because it's large print. It only has the parts of the book you're supposed to study, and it has big margins so that you can take notes. And so the page numbers are a little bit off in that. So I'm just going to go over real quick. In the doctor's opinion, XV in a regular big book is XXI in my book. And that's, I'm going to go through what I'm using because that's what this literature committee is using as well. And so when I say XXII, if you have a regular big book with you tonight, that's XXVI. So if you want to write that down on your page, if I say I'm on XXIII, I'm on XX, I mean, I'm sorry, if I say I'm on XXIII. That means in your book it's XXVII. If I say I'm on XXIV, that's XXVIII in your book. XXIX in my book, or XXV in my book is XXIX in your book. XXVI in my book is triple X in your book. XXVII in my book is XXXI in your book. And last but not least, XXVIII is XXXII in your book. Okay. So now that we have that out of the way, because I just don't want to have to count pages tonight, I'm gonna finish up the forward to the fourth edition. So I'm going to start in the middle of that first page of the forward to the fourth edition, where it says, as the message of recovery has reached larger numbers of people, it has also touched the lives of a vastly greater variety of suffering alcoholics. When the phrase "we are people who would normally not mix," page 17 of this book, was written in 1939, it referred to a fellowship composed largely of men and a few women with quite similar social, ethnic, and economic backgrounds. Like so much of AA's basic text, those words have proved to be far more visionary than the founding members could have ever imagined. The stories added to this edition represent a membership whose characteristics of age, gender, race, and culture have widened and have deepened to encompass virtually everyone the first 100 members could have hoped to reach. Here's a highlight. Our literature has preserved the integrity of the AA message. I'm going to read that again because I read my highlights twice. Our literature has preserved the integrity of the AA message. All right. So while our literature has preserved the integrity of the AA message, sweeping changes in society and as a whole are reflected in new customs and practices within the fellowship. Taking advantage of technical advances, for example, AA members with computers can participate in meetings online, sharing with fellow alcoholics across the country or around the world. In any meeting, anywhere, AAs share experience, strength, and hope with each other in order to stay sober and help other alcoholics. Modem to modem or face to face, AAs speak the language of the heart in all its power and simplicity. And one of the things that I want to point out, they're not necessarily highlights in my book, but I have them underlined. If you want to put boxes around them, that's fine too. I'm not going to tell you what to do, but they're two words, customs and practices. And the reason that that's important for me, where it says, while our literature has preserved the integrity of the AA message, sweeping changes in society as a whole are reflected in new customs and practices. What that doesn't say, which is just as important as what it does say, is it doesn't say steps and traditions. And that's the fourth tradition. And I know I'm not here to talk about traditions, but I can't help myself because the traditions are all over this book. And so customs and practices are what each group gets to autonomously decide for themselves, what they want to do. That does not include new steps or new traditions. And there's a portion of a really good reading in the book, Our Great Responsibility, that talks about how, you know, hoping, Bill talks about how he hopes that the way in which we carry the message will go on changing forever, although the traditions and the steps hopefully will never change. And I think that that's really important to decipher between customs and practices and our actual AA principles. So I have that highlighted. And then now we're on the doctor's opinion. Finally, the doctor's opinion. So we of Alcoholics Anonymous believe that the reader will be interested in the medical estimate of the plan of recovery described in this book. I think that's probably why the book opens with the doctor's opinion, right? Is because we needed that. We need to know what's the physically, like what is medically, physically wrong with us before we, just like in any other ailment, right? You're not going to go through chemo without first knowing that you have cancer. And so I think that's why the doctor's opinion and the medical estimate is at the front of the book. Convincing testimony must surely come from medical men who have had experiences with the suffering of our members and have witnessed our return to health. A well-known doctor, chief physician at a nationally prominent hospital specializing in alcoholic and drug addiction, gave Alcoholics Anonymous this letter. Now, the reason the font is a little bit different and the margins are a little bit different is because when it's Silkworth, when he's writing, it's going to be a different font and a different margin so that we can decipher and determine where he's writing and where the authors are writing. He says, to whom it may concern, I have specialized in the treatment of alcoholism for many years. Notice how he leaves the drug addiction out, because drug addiction and alcoholism are just part of his specialty, right? But he's not talking to us in Alcoholics Anonymous as someone who specializes in drug addiction. He's only talking to us about alcoholism because that's what we've asked him to do. So I have specialized in the treatment of alcoholism for many years. In late 1934, I attended a patient who, though he had been a competent businessman of good earning capacity, was an alcoholic of a type, an alcoholic of a type. Remember, I'm going to repeat myself when it's a highlight of mine. I had come to regard as hopeless, hopeless. In the course of the third treatment, he acquired certain ideas concerning the possible means of recovery. As part of his rehabilitation, he commenced to present his conceptions to other alcoholics, impressing upon them that they must do likewise with still others, impressing upon them that they might, that they must do likewise with still others. First of all, the reason why I highlighted alcoholic of a type is because that's the first time in the first 100, in the first 44 pages, plus the doctor's opinion, that is going to not just use the term alcoholic, because this book doesn't. It talks about alcoholic of our type, alcoholic of a type that I've come to regard as hopeless, alcoholic of the hopeless variety. Alcohol, you know, it really specifies that we're not just the person who's gotten physically addicted to alcohol because we've been drinking for too many years and we need to detox and then we're fine. It's an alcoholic of a hopeless variety. And so it's going to differentiate that. And on page 21, it says it in three different ways, including a real alcoholic. And I know that that offends some people, but I think it's really important to know what they're talking about because of how many times they differentiate. So that's my highlight there. And then my highlight with the, as part of its, his rehabilitation, this is one of the first musts in the book, right? Basically it's the theme of the whole book is you got to give it away to keep it. You got to help others in order to stay sober. And that's what this is saying. It says, as part of his rehabilitation, he commenced to present his conceptions to other alcoholics, impressing upon them that they must do likewise with still others. This has become the basis of a rapidly growing fellowship of these men and their families. This man and over 100 others have appeared to have recovered. I personally know scores of men who were, here we go, of the type, right? With whom other methods had failed completely. That's who this book is written for. This book isn't written for somebody who can go check into Chic Chadel and sober up off of an aversion therapy and then can drink with impunity or never again. This book is for the alcoholic of a hopeless variety. It is for the alcoholic of the type who other methods had failed completely. And you hear the term in AA meetings a lot, like the last house on the block, right? And what does that mean? That means this. It means I've tried all of the other methods. You know, and for me, AA was, it was not the first house on the block. It's not the first thing I tried. It just happens to be the last thing that I tried, but the first thing that I tried that actually worked. And that's what this is saying, that it's saying that they have saved this program for people like me, for the alcoholic of my type. And I appreciate that because I didn't know that I was of the type. I didn't know that I was of the hopeless variety when I first got sober. I didn't know that until reading this book. The facts appear to be of extreme medical importance because of the extraordinary possibilities of rapid growth inherent to this inherent in the group that they may mark a new epic in the annals of alcoholism. The word annals mean record keeping. So just for those of you taking notes, these men may have have a remedy for thousands of such situations. You may rely absolutely on anything they say about themselves. And I love this statement, and I have that highlighted too. Okay, you may rely absolutely on anything they say about themselves. And one of the reasons I have that highlighted is because it's kind of tradition eight, right? It's like, if somebody was paid to tell me what I needed to do, then that wouldn't have the depth and the weight that it would have when somebody is trying to tell me about themselves for fun and for free. They've been there, done that. They could write a book. They did. Right. And so that's what this is about. It's how I can't, all of the doctors and medical professionals and probation officers and teachers and counselors in my life who told me, you need to, they couldn't put Humpty Dumpty back together again. But I come to AA and I hear some guy that looks nothing like me at the podium saying, I don't know what happened, but when I drink, I can't stop. And I'm like, me too. And that's what this is about, right? So now it goes back to the regular font. Well, he signs his name, Very Truly Yours, William D. Silkworth, MD. Now it goes back to the regular font because it's us writing again. The physician who, at our request, he's talking about Silkworth, gave us this letter, has been kind enough to enlarge upon his views in another statement, which follows. In this statement, he confirms what we have, what we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe, that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. The body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. It didn't satisfy us to be told that we couldn't control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life, that we were in full flight from reality, or we were outright mental defectives. These things were true to some extent, in fact, to a considerable extent with some of us, but we are sure that our bodies were sickened as well. In our belief, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out the physical factor is incomplete. Any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out this physical factor is incomplete. Yeah, the crux of the problem is in the mind, right? But first, I have to be physically an alcoholic. I have to have that physical allergy. And so any picture of the alcoholic that is just talking about the ism, for instance, and I'm going to tell this story quickly. Those who have heard it before have heard the long version. I'm sitting in a women's meeting, 7 or 8 years ago, and this particular women's meeting, it meets at 5 o'clock on a Saturday. Ooh, this same time, and they're meeting right now. The format of this meeting is it's a big book study, and they read a passage of the book or whatever and share it. But if somebody is in their first, second, or third AA meeting ever, they ask someone in the attendees to qualify, which means they want somebody to tell why they're alcoholic, what that looks like, what a first step looks like, right? And so I'm in this meeting, and the chairperson asked who wanted to qualify, and this woman raises her hand, and I won't use her name because this is being recorded, but normally I do, and it's okay, and she's okay with it. But she raised her hand, and when she went to qualify or say how she knows she's an alcoholic for the new person in the room, she said, "Oh my gosh, I can't believe I was just before the meeting with a new person, and I was just saying this. So I'm very I'm ready to go here." And so yes, that's why I volunteered. How I know that I'm an alcoholic is because when I of my rage. She says, I am born restless, irritable, and discontent. And I remember when I was 8 years old, this is what this woman shared to qualify as an alcoholic. When I was 8 years old, she said, my neighbor friend, little girl from down the street, came over to play without calling first. She didn't have her mom call my mom. I got so mad, I beat her up right there on my porch. The end. What? Oh, hell no. Does not qualify you as an alcoholic. So my heart's beaten, and as a sort of direction from my sponsor, I am not supposed to share when I have that burning desire feeling. So instead, because I don't want to correct her, I highlighted this. Any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out the physical factor is incomplete. I had the little baby big book with me. And she was kitty corner, one row up, and I tapped her on the shoulder and I passed her the book and it's highlighted. And at that time, she had 12 years sober and no one had taken her through the book to qualify her. No one had helped her to qualify. I did end up working with her. I sponsored her for 5 years before she moved away. But one of the things that she was able to tell me is that she had always felt like a failure when it came to her 12-step work because she didn't sponsees didn't last, and she thought she was doing something wrong. And I love the instructions in this book because it wasn't her. She wasn't not likable. It was that she wasn't identifiable. Because she wasn't talking about the physical factor. When I drink, I get thirsty. You don't have to say it like the big book says it. Oh, I have a phenomenon of craving. No, you can say it in plain English. When I drink, I don't get quenched. I get more thirsty, right? I wake up doing weird things in weird places with weird people. You know what I mean? So that those things are very important, I think. And that's what Silkworth is saying here, or that's what the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. Second one, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out this physical factor is incomplete. So the doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us. Allergy, 1939 definition, abnormal reaction to a food or substance. So I know a lot of people come into AA and they're with me. They're like, okay, yeah. Oh my gosh. I start drinking and I black out too. I start drinking and I puke on myself too. And then I mention the allergy and they're like, what? That's where it's, wait a minute. I'm allergic to cats and I get all itchy. That doesn't happen when I drink. I'm allergic to, peanut butter and my throat swells up. That doesn't happen. I know what it's like to be allergic. Okay. But the definition in 1939, when this book was written, was the abnormal reaction to a food or substance. So my abnormal reaction to alcohol, when 90% of everyone in the world, I mean, quite honestly, and I'll just throw it out there, everybody likes the effect produced by alcohol. I mean, once in a while, you'll get some weirdo who doesn't, but you don't have to be an alcoholic to like the effects produced by alcohol, right? That's why a beer is $7 and a soda is $2. There's something extra in it, right? But the fact is that alcohol works for many people who aren't alcoholic. They can have a drink, experience that sense of ease and comfort, and then be done. And the abnormal reaction is, I'm not done until King Alcohol is done with me. The abnormal reaction for me is I don't get quenched. I get more thirsty. And that is the abnormal reaction. For the sake of time, I'm just going to skip over to the next page, which in my book is XXIII. I can't help myself. I'm sorry. Tradition 8, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 lines up from the bottom of the page. The highlight is the entire absence of profit motive. T8. Okay, so bottom of the page, the paragraph that starts out, of course, the alcoholic ought to be freed from his physical allergy. Let's talk about that, or physical craving. So very bottom of the page, of course, an alcoholic ought to be freed from his physical craving for liquor. And this often requires a definite hospital procedure before psychological measures can be of maximum benefit. So what they're calling a craving, and my highlight is physical craving, what they're calling a craving, what the big book calls a craving, what Bill W. calls a craving, what Silkworth calls a craving, has nothing to do with the mind, right? So I don't get the phenomenon of craving until I ingest the alcohol. Remember, neck up, neck down. So you'll hear well-meaning 2-3 months sober people talking in meetings about, oh, I was craving a drink really bad yesterday. No, they're talking about the obsession. They're talking about the neck up, right? The head, the crux of the problem. The craving doesn't happen until after the drink goes down. That's the physical craving. That's the physical allergy. So what they're saying here is before the psychological methods, before the steps can be done, sometimes the definite hospital procedure, getting rid of the craving, the physical craving for liquor, needs to be cleaned up for the results to work with the neck up stuff. So we believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy. There it is again. Allergy, that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. Let's talk about that word, because here's where all loopholes get closed. It does not say, and I like to read it in this literature, what it doesn't say just as much as what it does say, because I used to read what it doesn't say. I used to read a lot of the white and not so much of the black. And what this used to sound like to me is the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and rarely occurs in the average temperate drinker. But it says it never occurs. So, you know, those Russian roulette drunks, right? I'm sure you've worked with some of them. If you sponsor, you're going to get one of them once in a while. And it's like, oh no, sometimes I can have just two and I'm fine. Sometimes I can have just three and I'm fine. I just don't know when that is going to be, right? It's like playing Russian roulette. I don't know, once out of every five times, I get completely wasted and I wake up doing things I shouldn't be doing or in jail, right? But I never know when that's going to be. Well, this closes the loophole. It doesn't say, so it says that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. So even if it only occurs once out of every 3 times you drink, it never occurs in the average temperate drinker. So it might be something you might want to take a look at. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. What is any form at all? I mean, if I'm learning anything from maybe some clever speakers that like to get laughs, I have heard in pill or powder form. Alcohol doesn't come in pill or powder form. If you look up the word alcohol in a dictionary, it says that it's a liquid. It says that you drink it. There's a pamphlet. It's called Frequently Asked Questions in Alcoholics Anonymous. And on page 9, it goes into detail about what alcohol in any form means. It means a short beer, it means wine, liqueurs, it means beer, it means hard liquor. But it doesn't talk about cocaine in and crank and crystal meth and heroin. It just it talks about alcohol in any form, meaning there are lots of different forms of alcohol, including mouthwash, vanilla extract. So that's just a little bit of a myth buster. Let's go all the way down to the bottom of that page. Again, XXIV, and it says men and women drink essentially because they like the effects produced by alcohol. Now, let me say this again. This does not say alcoholics drink because they like the effects produced by alcohol. This says men and women like the effects produced by alcohol, right? So even if you're not alcoholic, there's something in it, right? It gives you that I can breathe and it works. The difference between me as someone who can't drink responsibly because I have a physical allergy to it is I can't stop. The person who can have a drink and get the sense of ease and comfort then stops and makes dinner, watches TV, plays some cards, and goes to bed. Brushes their teeth. At the very bottom of the page, at the sentence that starts, they are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks which they see other people taking with impunity, right? Because there's those normal people out there again that can have a few drinks and get that sense of ease and comfort. And they can drink with impunity, meaning they don't wake up hungover. They don't wake up wondering where their car is. So after they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops. So it says after they've succumbed, right? So that phenomenon of craving, again, it's going to reiterate and reiterate and reiterate that phenomenon of craving only comes after they have succumbed. It only comes after you take that drink, goes down the throat, and then the phenomenon of craving develops. They pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution to not drink again. This is repeated over and over. And unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there is little hope of his recovery. On the other hand, as strange as this may seem to those who do not understand, and anybody who might be offended to think that, you're going to get control back because you've heard in the meetings that we never get that back. I might want to close your ears at this part. So, once a psychic change has occurred, right? So, once we've been through steps 1 through 9, Once that psychic change has occurred as a result of the steps, the very same person who seemed doomed, who had so many problems he despaired of ever solving them, suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol. That's when that problem has been removed, right? The 10th step promises. The only effort necessary being that required to follow a few simple rules. So what are the few simple rules? Well, it's not a 9-step program. We recover through working the action steps of 1 through 9, but then trust God, clean house, help others. Steps 10, 11, and 12, wash, rinse, and repeat every single day. And it's as easy as that, right? Dr. Bob, in his last talk, when he could barely stand at the podium, he said it sums it up. Love and service, right? We know what love is and we know what service is. And all that's required is these few simple rules. Trust God, clean house, help others, wash, rinse, and repeat. All the way down at the bottom of the page, I do not hold with those who believe that alcoholism is entirely a problem of mental control. He's saying it again, because he's already said to us, right, that the body is just as abnormal as the mind. I have had many men who have, for example, worked a period of months on some problem or business deal, which was to be settled on a certain date favorable to them. So they're saying something good is going to happen. And so they don't want to go and screw it up. It's not like they're about to lose their job or have a divorce or whatever. They're looking forward to something. So something positive is about to happen. But they took a drink a day or so prior to the date, right? And once that drink goes down the throat, now it's no longer the mental obsession. Now it's the physical allergy. And then the phenomenon of craving at once became paramount to all other interests, so that the important appointment was not met. These men were not drinking to escape. They were drinking to overcome a craving beyond their mental control. They were drinking to overcome a craving beyond their mental control. So once we take that first drink, it's no longer a mental thing. We're not drinking because we have low willpower, because it's a physical thing. It's that physical phenomenon of craving. And so I know that it sounds like he's repeating this kind of over and over again. He is. It's that important. There are many situations which arise out of the phenomenon of craving, which cause men to make the supreme sacrifice rather than to continue to fight. The classification of alcoholics seem most difficult and in much detail outside of the scope of this book. There are, of course, type one, the psychopaths who are emotionally unstable. And I actually wrote in type one. You guys can do it if you want to. You don't have to. We are all familiar with this type. They are always going on the wagon for keeps. They are over remorseful and make many resolutions, but never a decision. Type two, there is the type of man who is unwilling to admit he cannot take a drink. He plans various ways of drinking. He changes his brand or his environment. Type three, there's a type who always believes that after being entirely free from alcohol for a period of time, he can take a drink without danger. Type four, there's the manic depressant type, who is perhaps the least understood by his friends and about whom a whole chapter could be written. And then type five, then there are types entirely normal in every respect, except in the effect alcohol has upon them. They are often able, intelligent, friendly people. That's my type, right? That's who it is. No, but it's funny because that type, and my side notes, if you guys want to do the reconciliations with me throughout this, and you don't have to, but my side notes, as to where the rest of the places in the first 44 pages are going to say this over and over again and reiterate is on page 7. This is what I have written by that last type 5. It's going to talk about this type on page 7, page 21, page 26, and page 38. There's more, but those are the ones that are really black and white. And I'll just go over those real quick. So on page 7, so this says that they're entirely normal in every aspect except for the effect alcohol has upon them. Because I was one of those people who came in and I had never paid a bill late in my life. I wasn't coming in on a court card. I wasn't coming in, you know, jail. I could pay my bills. I could pick up my daughter from school. I could do all those things. It was just once I drank, all bets were off. I had no control whatsoever after I took that first drink. And so on page 7, Bill, he was just like me. I mean, I really resonated with this right in the middle of the page. It says, it relieved me somewhat to learn that in alcoholics, the will is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating liquor, though it often remains strong in other respects, right? I have good willpower. I still do. It just didn't work when it came to combating liquor. Didn't work with alcohol. We can fast forward to page 21, about 11 lines up from the bottom of the page. It says he's often perfectly sensible and well-balanced concerning everything except liquor, right? Another one, because we're talking about alcoholic insanity. We're not talking about insanity like chewing on your sleeves or, you know, needing a straitjacket or going in a padded room. We're talking about normal in every aspect, except for when it comes to combating liquor. Page 26, about 12 lines up from the bottom of the page. He seemed quite rational and well-balanced with respect to his other problems, yet had no control whatsoever over alcohol. Page 38. However intelligent we may have been in other respects where alcohol had been involved, we have been strangely insane. So that's what the alcoholic insanity is. It only comes as a result of alcoholic insanity when it comes to combating liquor. When you hear in meetings about somebody saying, oh, my alcoholic insanity was really flaring up today with my road rage in the car or whatever, it's like, no, that's human. Those are just your human character defects. That has nothing to do with alcoholic insanity. Alcoholic insanity is the inability to leave it alone, that strange mental blank spot where I'm sane in every aspect except for when it comes to combating liquor. So moving on back to the doctor's opinion. All of these and many others have one symptom in common. You would think after sitting in meetings for 90 meetings in 90 days, after listening to all of the things that we have in common, inferiority complex, egomaniacism, fear, selfishness, resentment, we like chocolate instead of vanilla. I don't know. You name it. I've heard it. You would think that us alcoholics have more than one thing in common. No, us human beings have a lot in common. But those aren't alcoholism. All of these and many others have one symptom in common, that they can't start drinking without developing the phenomenon of craving. I am bodily and mentally different from my fellows. This phenomenon, as we have suggested, may be the manifestation of an allergy which differentiates these people and sets us apart as a distinct entity. I'm sorry, I keep on saying us instead of them because I am one of us, but this is the doctor writing about them. So about us. So, you know, I come in wanting, I was suffering of terminally uniqueness. I mean, my whole life, not just when I came into AA, right? Like all my life, I wanted to be the Fruit Loop in the bowl of Cheerios, if you will. And I want to stand out and I have attention seeking behaviors. And my sponsor took me here and said, you know, your uniqueness is going to kill you. Drop the andas. You're not an alcoholic and an addict or an alcoholic, whatever. You're one among many. You're just an alcoholic among alcoholics. And if there's anywhere that gives you permission to be unique, it is being unique in that you're an alcoholic. You are just like the rest of us. And this is where you get to be set apart as a distinct entity. When you take a drink, the drink takes you. But that's the same as everyone else here. That's what we have in common. And so that is what sets me apart as a distinct entity, because only one out of every 10 people experience what we experience when we drink alcohol. And that's the only one thing that happens.
All audio and video files on the District6AA.org website or the District 6 in Area 15 YouTube channel are for personal use only. Reproduction, distribution, and commercial use are not permitted. In accordance with District 6 current practice, no faces are shown in our videos and audio is scrubbed for anonymity prior to publishing. Contributors whose voices are heard have given record and release consent. Opinions expressed by the presenter are their own and do not necessarily represent the group conscience of District 6 as a whole.